Welcome today. We have Dr. Lauren Zimsky with us today for an interview. She is an ophthalmologist out in Denver, Colorado, and she's been in her private practice since 2007. She's insurance-based, but she is doing more specializing in dry eye care, which has led to being able to do a little more in the cash service kind of hybrid type practice realm. So welcome, Dr. Zimsky. It's so glad to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I kind of want to dive right in, you know, get an idea of your experience with private practice. So tell me a little about your background and kind of what made you decide that private practice was the right thing for you.
Well, I don't know that my story applies to everybody, but I basically did my residency. I finished in Denver in 2007, and I really wanted to stay in Denver, and it's a competitive market.
Okay.
So there just were not a lot of jobs. There were not a lot of jobs available. So basically, I needed to figure out something sort of outside of the box if I really wanted to stay here. And so I was fortunate. I didn't have a lot of school debt weighing me down. So I kind of took the opportunity to kind of start just looking to see what was available. And there were really no jobs. And I wound up just actually sending a letter out to different practices.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
the old school way. Yeah, it was, well, and also this was a long time ago. This was back in 2007. So there wasn't as much of an online.
Right.
Everything wasn't online. I don't think Indeed or existed.
Yeah.
So it was just, it was a different time. And so I sent this letter out, and then somebody, an older doc in town, responded that he had been solo practice for essentially forever, but was looking to kind of bring somebody on.
Okay.
But it was a pretty non-traditional. He essentially helped me to kind of start up my practice, but we were really space sharing. I was not employed by, it was my own practice.
Yes.
It was my own ID. I had to get my own insurance contracts.
Yeah, this is what I did too.
Yeah. So he helped me. I don't know if he really helped me, but he had somebody in the office that kind of knew that stuff.
Right.
And I feel like maybe it was a little bit easier back then, because I feel like that stuff was not that big. It wasn't that
big. Yeah, it wasn't quite so convoluted. Yeah.
It wasn't quite as convoluted. So I got my insurance contracts, and he was pretty booked out. So that helped, because he would throw patients my way and stuff like that. But I essentially built my practice. It's always been private practice, but we were affiliated with a hospital. We're in a medical office building attached to a hospital here.
Yeah.
They had a physician liaison at the time, and she actually took you around to meet primary care, like referral providers in the area and stuff like that. So he didn't do anything to like market me or really help me get started, but I had a space to use and I had employees. And so it was sort of this kind of funky hybrid model, which I think I probably wouldn't have done it if I didn't have something like that, but it definitely came with downsides down the road.
Right. Yeah. They all have the good and the bad. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was how I got my start in private practice, and I just kind of built from there.
Yeah. What were some of the ways, other than like going around and meeting with providers, what were some of the other ways that you remember like really trying to drive patients in your door when you were first getting started?
I mean, that was probably the main way. I mean, at that time, because our building is attached to the hospital, I mean, honestly, like I would go over, they have a doctor's dining area. So I would eat lunch. You know, it was definitely more old school. It was not, I mean, there was nothing online.
Okay.
It was all, I mean, and I think maybe it was, and, you know, obviously there was online presence. But I think because I was with this kind of old school doctor, it was just kind of not really part of our practice. We weren't very, we had paper charts. He was very opposed to EMRs and very dinosaur-like.
Yeah,
so I think
yeah.
If I had been in, I think if maybe if I had been with somebody else or in a different situation.
Yep. Well, but at least it gives you a good
been a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. At least gives you a good appreciation for the tech part of things now, right? Like, I think if you do start, because I kind of started the same way, it was like, it was mostly kind of paper charting and like very inefficient systems, which I mean, for that person, that worked really well for them, like for the pace that they moved at. But yeah, for what I wanted to do, that was like, nope, this just, this isn't going to work. But at least you get to know what doesn't work, you know? So, and then
yeah,
you're,
it's, I mean, it's all a learning process.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you're pretty passionate about like private practice being kind of the best option for doctors and patients. So even having like gone into this kind of more by necessity, how do you feel private practice is like crucial now for that relationship? Like, would you do anything different?
I mean, I honestly don't think it's for every doctor because you do have to understand the business part of it,
yeah,
or want to at least do that. So mm-hmm. for me, I just couldn't work for somebody.
Yes, I call myself unemployable regularly. Yeah.
Right. So for me, it's kind of like, even with all the headaches that come with it, I know that there's really not another option that I would be appropriate for me. But I also know other doctors that I don't ever see them really doing the administrative business side of things, and they have like zero interest in that. So mm-hmm. I respect that. But I mean, I feel like it all comes down to autonomy. Like I need my own autonomy.
Yeah.
So for me, it's the right choice, but I don't know that that is true for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so once you got started, how did it grow from there? Like, how did you stop sharing that office? Did the person retire? Like, how'd you get to where you are now?
Oh, there was a lot of drama.
Okay. Okay. Well, we don't have to spill the tea here, but
no,
we could later.
It's fine. I mean, I think it's good to, I think what I've learned through this process is that, you know, if you're going to even share space, so we weren't, our businesses were separate tax IDs. Mm-hmm. We billed separately, but we shared the same space. We shared the same employees.
Yeah.
And so we were still tied together,
yep.
Which looking back on that now, that is not a good situation because you don't really have the autonomy to make your own business decisions in that situation. And so basically my practice grew and we were outgrowing the space, and he was very resistant to basically moving to an EMR, moving to a larger space. He had no desire to actually grow the practice. He just wanted to ride it out until he retired.
Right.
So I basically, at that point, part of ophthalmology, we have pretty high overhead. Mm-hmm. And I never really wanted to work more than 4 days a week. And so part of my mindset back then was that I really didn't think I could do it on my own. I felt like it didn't make sense because we have mm-hmm. lasers and we have expensive things, and it doesn't make sense to have those pieces of pricey equipment sitting in the office being unused, where if you have a larger practice or you're sharing them with somebody, then you're offsetting the expenses of all of our expensive equipment that just keep getting more expensive.
It's not getting cheaper. That's for sure.
It's not getting cheaper. And so I think my mindset was that I just couldn't really do it on my own. So I started looking for somebody younger, you know, that wanted to kind of share space and, you know, join forces, you know, to grow the practice. One of my co-residents, he had actually moved to Texas, but he had family here and was interested in moving back here. Oh. And then that kind of fell through though, just for various reasons.
Sure.
The cost of living here is way higher than
Yep. Yep. Texas. I can relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and I just, so I eventually at my surgery center, the business development, you know, the business, the sales guy, essentially, the surgery center that knows everybody in town, he started talking to me and he's like, well, I know a guy that really wants to come Denver. He, you know, grew up here and he's lived in like Michigan and Seattle, but he wants to come back. So he introduced us and we decided to exit, like to basically share a space again, and build it out, which I am in that space now. Okay. And so that's how I eventually got out. My older partner actually came with us for about 3 months. And then we opened the space. Like we basically moved in at the beginning of COVID. It was March of 2020.
Yes. Yeah.
That is when I went from paper charts to an EMR. Beautiful. Couldn't even get internet service hooked up in our suite because of COVID.
Oh my God.
It was like this total nightmare. And I was trying to figure it all out at the onset of COVID.
Yep.
And the sad part about it is the construction, when we were remodeling the space, that all kind of moved forward because construction was still going on, but you couldn't actually get any of the other services that you needed to open up a practice, but we had to move into it in June of 2020.
Yes.
So that was sort of a nightmare. And then I started to learn very quickly that the guy that I was sharing the space with was really not interested in managing any of that. So I was doing it all. So suffice it to say that else that ended tumultuously. My old partner basically had a meltdown in the middle of clinic because of the EMR.
Oh no.
He left in the middle of the day with like an afternoon full of patients and just said he like wasn't.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was a lot of drama. Yeah. So I got to a point eventually where I was like, I need this on my own.
Yeah.
And so I wound up the new partner left my space. The old partner had been gone. So I'm by myself now.
Right.
I was super stressed out at the very beginning of it because our overhead is really high. So then I essentially kind of had to figure out how to increase my revenue for this to make sense. And I had a lot of panicking, but it worked out.
Yeah. That's so fun. Our stories are so similar. I did the same thing. I built out the office out of a space sharing situation in 2020. So I completely empathize with that.
it was terrible.
It was terrible. Would not recommend it. However, like it worked out great. I mean, you know, obviously now I'm super happy with it, but yeah, did it put some wrenches in everything? Absolutely, especially if you're trying to build out a space and get staff and do all the things. So with that, what do you feel like were some of the big like mental hurdles that you kind of had to get over during that time as you're looking at this huge amount of overhead and like, okay, this is all coming down to me. Like, what do you feel like you had to kind of shift internally in order to kind of get yourself through that?
I mean, I think I was at a place mentally where just dealing with these other people was just really taking a toll on me.
Sure.
I just got to a point where like I'm like, this is not how I saw things going, and this is not what I want. This is way too stressful and I'm tired. I mean, I always just kind of carried the weight for these two sort of older men that thought they knew everything and really knew absolutely nothing about running a medical
business.
Practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I was just really naive to begin with, thinking that like they had some sort of knowledge that I did not possess
or couldn't learn. Right.
Right. And I was like, well, I'm not really a business person. And so I had that mindset. But I think when we moved in COVID, I was the one who got the whole practice up and running during COVID. But I think that gave me the confidence. Then, you know, I started looking back on things and I was like, well, why do I think I'm dependent on this?
Right. Why am I assuming I can't do this?
I'm like, I was actually the one who did it. So why do I have this identity of being somebody that isn't a business person that doesn't have the ability to do this when I was actually the one that did it? But I think part of it is just, I was so busy.
Right.
And I didn't have the bandwidth to kind of sit back and really think about this.
Right.
And then at some point I was just so miserable, to be honest with you, like sharing
yeah,
you know, dealing with these people and all the headaches that came with it. Mm-hmm. I felt like I just didn't have a choice but to figure. I mean, I felt like I was kind of backed into a corner. I'm like, I either need to figure this out or just get out of practice because this is not sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like being in a bad marriage.
It just really wasn't sustainable. Yeah. It's like being in a marriage without like any of the benefits.
Right. You're like, what am I getting out of this? Yeah.
So it really wasn't until I actually kicked my space sharing partner out. Fortunately, the lease was in my name. And I actually kicked him out in July of 2023. So it really hasn't been that long that I've been completely solo. I'm in a space that is much bigger than what I need. I mean, I did think about subleasing and bringing somebody in. But honestly, I was just so over dealing with other people.
Getting a little bit of PTSD on the space sharing thing.
Yeah, it was PTSD. Yeah. It was definitely PTSD for sure. Yeah. I'm like, I just don't want to. And so I just took a different approach. I was like, I'm going to figure out how to make this lucrative and worthwhile, even if I'm in a space that's too big for me. And I'm not going to rent it out to somebody that I have to deal with, which may or may not work out.
Right. So how did you go about that? Where, I mean, you've got this need now to like cover this space that's a little bigger than you need. You know, you've got to increase revenue. So how did you do it?
Well, so before, I mean, I had been kind of preparing for this.
Right.
So it definitely didn't, the whole kicking him out in July of 2023, I would say for about 8 months before that, I was being fairly strategic about how I was going to pull this off.
Absolutely.
So it's not like I just woke up one day.
Right. And we're done. Yeah, no. It takes some planning. Yes.
It didn't play out that way. You know, dry eye has always been a part of ophthalmology. I mean, it's the most common ophthalmic condition, but it's hard to treat. Patients are actually quite unhappy. So there can be a lot of chair time involved with it. Ophthalmology tends to be a really high volume specialty. It's a surgical specialty. So a lot of ophthalmologists don't really want to deal with it.
Right.
It's sort of like this redheaded stepchild of ophthalmology. And it's always like, oh, use some eye drops that don't really work.
Right.
I live in Denver. It's a really dry climate. And I just had this patient base of people that were just coming in, and I was doing the same thing that everybody else was doing. Use some eye drops, you know, with some in-office things, punctal plugs, just very basic treatments that really are not effective. Mm-hmm. And I happened to meet somebody on a, I don't know if it's an ophthalmology Facebook group or a private practice, but I feel like some of these online like Facebook groups can be really helpful for the exchange of information these days.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And she opened up her own cash-based dry eye practice. It's actually in Seattle. And I started talking to her on Facebook, and this was probably the fall of 2022.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, you know, I feel like I should offer more services for this because nobody's really doing it here in Denver, you know, or doing it at a high level. Mm-hmm. Everybody says they do it, but nobody, you know, it's not really sufficient. And so she was very encouraging. She's like, yeah, it's really rewarding because people are really desperate for help. And
there's a need.
There's a really high need for this.
Yeah.
And it's been really great. And so I was like, okay, let me explore further. So this was in November of 2022. I went to a conference in Jacksonville, Florida, that was basically like a whole weekend of just like dry eye care.
Beautiful.
And kind of learning like the nitty gritty of it. And IPL, intense pulse light, is one of the kind of mainstays of therapy. And it's a cash-based procedure. And it required me, you know, I started seriously thinking about purchasing an IPL. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I knew that I was going to be getting rid of my partner.
Right.
So I'm not usually a risk taker. So that's the other piece to this is I am not a risk taker. And I decided though that this piece of equipment was really essential to my to developing this dry eye practice.
Yeah.
And it was almost $100,000.
Yep.
But I think the big piece of it was just kind of letting go of that fear and, you know, risk adverse piece of my personality. And so it was like the end of, I mean, I bought it like December 30th of 2022. I like signed on the dotted line so I could get my tax.
You're like, I remember the date. I remember where I was.
I do.
It's a huge purchase.
It was the biggest purchase I had made. Yeah. And it was by myself. And knowing that that I was going to try and build this practice up and, you know, basically be solo.
Yeah.
So I just sucked it up and I bit the bullet. And I think I didn't get trained on it until February of really of like 23. So by the time it got, because I had to get delivered, it comes from Germany.
Sure. And
then you have to get trained on it. And then I had never really talked to patients about that. I mean, I was in the insurance world. I really wasn't used to talking to patients
about cash services. Yep.
About cash services. And I mean, that was a whole nother, I was actually learning to do the procedures, but I was also learning how to market it and how to, I'd never really done online marketing.
Yeah.
I had never really done these procedures. So it was a pretty steep learning curve, but there's nothing like necessity to motivate you.
It'll motivate you right into doing it. Yes. Well, and you kind of put yourself in a position where like laser's here. Now what?
Exactly. So I hired a marketing and branding company to build out a new website.
Good.
And so they basically did my website. That took a while. They did, it wasn't just the website. They did a whole branding book and marketing analysis and new logos and color schemes and all the stuff that I wasn't really familiar with. So I spent quite a bit of money on that.
Yep.
I was just spending.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you got to spend money to make it.
Right. Which was just not something that I had been comfortable with in the past.
Yeah.
But I was just like, this is it. Like, I'm going for it. I think that there's a huge need for this. I don't think, I really don't think it's that big a risk. Like, I don't think it's going to fail.
Right.
And I've got to like go all in if I'm really make this work. So I went all in. Then I figured out what you really need is a camera system to take pictures and show patients what is going on with the process of their eye, because then it just, when they can actually see what you see and you can explain to them, this is what is going on. This is the reason that your eyes are so uncomfortable or red. Yep. Whatever is going on with them, and you can show them, and they're kind of like, whoa, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So then I bought another. So then in like April of 2023, I got this imaging camera system for like another $18,000. So I was just like throwing,
like, here you go. Here's another check. It's
this is all going to be good. So I basically. So I basically did that. But when I got that, and then I just started, you know, talking to patients about it. And it was, you know, it was a, like, it was a challenge at first, but it was one of those hurdles I just had to get past, because it wasn't going to work if I didn't talk to patients about it.
Right.
And it's just one of those things. Once you, it's like that initial inertia is really hard.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
then once you do it, it's not a big deal.
Yeah. The coaching clients that I work with, like this, that kind of sales talk is such a huge part of what we like train in and go through, because you're right. It's like, it's getting that initial inertia, and then also making sure that, you know, the talk that you're going to have is as easy as possible. So, you know, using whatever, you know, explanation you can, physical, visual, you know, auditory, whatever it is that you can do to really like show the patient, you know, hey, this is why you need this. That seems to just sell the service in itself. And then like, you don't have, you know, it's going to work, you know, it's a treatment that's going to work. So there's like no reason to feel salesy about it. But I think that's a big kind of hang up for a lot of people, is we just get it stuck in our heads that like, oh God, I feel like a used car salesman. But it's like, no, like you're literally just showing the patient, like, this is why this is going to work for you. But it's hard when you're having to ask them to pay out of pocket. That takes a little getting used to. For sure.
Yeah, it was definitely a hurdle. That was a hurdle for me to get past. And even now I feel as though I still continue to kind of You know, I used to have these ideas like, oh, I'll talk about it with people I think that are going to like cash pay for things.
Sure.
And
sure.
I have learned since I've been, you know, I've really, it hasn't been that long that I've really been in this space and doing these cash pay procedures. But I mean, I quickly learned that you really can't predict who's going to go for it and who is not. I mean, that's been shocking to me.
Yes. Yeah. You just have to literally have the conversation with everybody that's eligible to have the conversation with. And
yes.
And I always tell people, like, even if somebody says no, and the, and let's say the price objection is really, truly their objection to it, right? Which may be their situation, and that's fine. You got practice talking about it. You got more comfortable with it. So, right. You know, it's still a win for the next person that you're going to talk to about it, who might be able to afford it, who might go for
right.
it. You just
that's
don't know.
That's a good way of thinking about it. And also, I think just getting comfortable, like, not everyone's going to do it. There are going to be people that say no. Mm-hmm. That means nothing.
Right.
It's not.
It's okay. It's not a personal thing. Yeah.
Right. It's not anything personal against you. It's not. And maybe they want it and they can't afford it. And, you know, I have patients, you know, and it's as far as their, you know, how much money they have. I mean, I have patients that have money that would never cash pay for things.
Right.
And then patients that don't have a ton of money, but they, this is really important to them. And,
right.
they're, you know, they want to feel better and
right.
they're willing to, you know, they're willing to make sacrifices
yeah.
to invest in this treatment. And as long as you deliver, I think that
yeah.
that. I think that that's fine, but just not having a preconceived notion about who
right.
is going to want a service. I present it to everybody that
yep.
it may make
yep.
a difference for. And if they don't want it, great.
Okay.
If they do want it,
yeah.
great.
Yeah, it's
like
okay.
Not, and it's not like a mental, it's not a big thing in my head anymore.
Right, right. And I think that just comes with practice on it, right? Like the more times you present it to people, the less... I don't know, the more, you know, outcomes you see, like the less you start taking it personal that it's like, okay, they're like, I did something wrong about how I presented that. Like, can you always be improving how you're presenting it? Absolutely. And I think it's good to like reflect back on that, but like, it really has very little to do with you. And I think that's the thing we all get caught on. Like, it has to do with the patient and what they, you know,
and,
how much it bothers them and what they can do and what they can't do.
Seeing the results over time and
yeah.
seeing how much of an impact it does make also
yes.
helps, because I don't feel like I'm selling some snake oil. I feel
right.
like
right.
treatment is really
right.
effective.
Yes.
So.
Yes. And people do pick
and
up
I,
on that.
I did rent. Fortunately, I didn't purchase it. There was a thermal pulsation device that we use called LipoFlow, and you were able to rent it for the year for pretty inexpensive.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so I was able to rent it, but of course, like when the year was up that, they wanted me to purchase the piece of equipment, but the disposable cost was just really, really high on it.
Yeah.
So I just think also learning the business piece of like these cash pay
yep.
pieces of equipment, like you might shell out more up front for the piece of equipment, but then
right.
what's it going to cost you every time a patient comes in?
Yes.
Yes. A different way of thinking. And the reality is these, you know, sales guys are always promising you the world on these
oh,
devices.
Oh yeah, that's their job. Literally their job.
And that's a whole nother conversation,
oh, yeah.
kind of learning how to navigate that
yes.
and not get sucked into buying things that,
yep, yep.
I mean, because you could get sucked into buying a lot of stuff if you really listen to
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say too, the one thing that I consistently hear, and it's not to like rag on the sales reps, because like I definitely have had some sales reps that have been amazing, but their job is to sell you the equipment. And a lot of times the big complaint that I hear from doctors is like, I got promised all of this marketing help and all of the, like that they're going to help bring me patients for this. And it's like, that is consistently said for every single piece of equipment or service that I've ever heard.
Yes.
And honestly, if you just pretend like they're never going to do that, you just won't be disappointed. Like, come up with your own marketing plan. Because
exactly.
odds
and
are they're
exactly
going to disappear.
That's exactly what I did. I built this website out. Like, I knew I had to figure this out. I was not depending on them.
Yeah.
So I got this LipoFlow device. I rented it. And the activators were just really expensive every time.
Yeah.
And they were single use. And
oh,
and I, like, it does help, but for like a really brief period of time. But you have to charge a lot of money for it because
yeah.
the activators are so expensive. And I'm like, this is just not worth the cost
right.
that I have to people.
Right. I love that you were able to rent it though. Like that's kind of an interesting idea to pitch out to a company is like, can I just rent this for a period of time so that we can see if this is going to work?
I'm like, the results with this are not long-term and I'm not going to charge somebody this kind of money for some kind of a result that is not going to last.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so at the end of the year, I just got rid of it.
I love that idea. I think that would be a really good thing to like ask people, you know, can I rent this for a period of time? What do you feel like, you know, looking back, especially over the last like few years where you've done a lot more of like kind of the cash services and, you know, really been on your own, what do you feel like were kind of the biggest lessons you had to learn in terms of the business side of things?
I mean, to be honest, even though I was really scared to be on my own, I was pretty much running the business before.
Right.
Like I had people
slow transition. Yeah.
I think the biggest thing was just really figuring out. I mean, the biggest piece was figuring out how to pay for everything when I wasn't splitting the cost with somebody else. So that I actually was the one managing employees and doing, working with the bookkeeper and, you know, I try to outsource as much as I can to contractors. Like I don't want my front, you know, I don't want somebody in my office doing the bookkeeping. I'd rather have somebody that just does bookkeeping.
Yep. Have really a professional do it. Like,
I have a professional bookkeeper that works directly with my accountant and she's the one who manages all that. So I outsourced my billing. That was another huge thing for me. Yeah. Just because I feel like the less people that you have to manage in a small practice. Now, if you're in a bigger practice, if you're in a larger practice and you've got an office manager and you've got somebody in between you and sort of all these responsibilities, I think it's a little bit different. But if you have a small practice where you're trying to manage all these things, I just think having less employees and outsourcing to somebody that's just an expert in what they do is just less headaches. I was fortunate. I found a really good billing company. I have, they've done a great job. It's like not something I really think about anymore.
Great. That's ideal.
Well, and I think, you know, the problem is we used to have in-house billers. It doesn't work. In my opinion, it doesn't work in a small practice because you need some redundancy. Like if they go on vacation, you can't have all your billing stop.
Right.
Or if you know, and so unless you're a big enough entity to have multiple billers, like I would never go back to having one in-house biller. It's just too risky.
Yeah. Yeah. That I had a similar experience. I tried to do the in-house billing. Actually, I think I've had an in-house biller at three different times in my career. Two of which were an office sharing situation. So, you know, that was what they were doing. So I kind of, like you said, I kind of had to go along with it. Like, okay.
Right, and then,
you know, kind of lost my mind when I found a drawer full of super bills that had just been like tossed in there rather than submitted and was like, we're past timely filing. Like, I mean, it was like the amount
the
of oversight
experience.
Yeah. That you have to have when you have that specializing of an employee in the office. And it's really not something you want to just pass off to somebody to be like, oh, you can do billing. Great. I'm going to have you do it. Like this is your revenue, you know, like that's a big responsibility. So I agree. I use an outsourced billing company and, you know, they give me reports, we check in. I think it's definitely better if you can be in that kind of more CEO mode for your business in that sense, where it's like, you're getting the reports from your marketing team, from your billing team, from your bookkeeper. And it's like, great. Now I have the overview, high level view. I need it. And I go back to seeing patients. So.
So I think for me, it was just like the hard part of that is finding the right people.
Absolutely.
Like finding the right bookkeeper, finding an accountant that actually is going to be proactive about helping you lower your tax bill, finding a biller that's actually going to chase money and not just write things off because it's a pain to go after it.
Right.
So I think the real challenge in that is just finding the right people, but it can be done. And that is priceless. Like that's just totally worth it because once you find the right people, then you don't really have to oversee at such a micro level.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. And nobody wants to micromanage. Let's be real. So now, okay. So let's talk a little bit about side gigs. Cause you went off on a side gig. I'm just curious about this. How did this happen? What did you do?
So I would say it was probably like 2015, 2016, because I had been in practice since 2007. And I just watched my reimbursements decline every single year. I mean, I think when I first started in private practice, reimbursement for a cataract surgery was $900, and it's down right now to just over $500. And so I watching this, I was like, okay, how is this trajectory that we're on is not sustainable until I retire. So what am I gonna do? And I think a lot of ophthalmologists, ophthalmology is a fairly high volume specialty. So I think a lot of ophthalmologists, and still what I hear, they just respond by being by just increasing their volume and just seeing more patients. But I didn't like I just first of all, I wouldn't be happy doing that. I mean, I just don't want to feel like my practice is some kind of mill. And I think the second piece of that is I just didn't really think that that was the answer, because we're not making widgets. Like, there's only so much you can, you can't like increase your volume indefinitely. You're only one person.
Yeah, you only have so many hours in a day. That's what I tell people.
So I just didn't feel like that was really the solution. I didn't want to do it, and I didn't feel like it was really the solution to the problem. So I basically, I had done some workers' comp, like just kind of throughout. I got accredited when I first started in practice through the state. We have to be accredited here, sort of a state-run thing. And so I had done a little bit of workers' comp, but when you're on their like website, on their like listings, like attorneys would reach out to you from like time to time about like reviewing cases. And so I started doing that, some of it through workman's comp, but then other attorneys just started finding me. I guess I never, it wasn't really necessarily intentional, but you know, in the medical legal world, the it's just, you know, you set your rate and attorneys usually say, okay, great. There's no
There's no negotiating. There's no, you didn't include this modifier, so we're just not going to pay you. Like it's just,
No,
here
it's a totally
it
different. And then I don't know. I was contacted by a third party that kind of hooks up experts with attorneys, and some of those cannot be good deals, but this was a good deal for me. They let you set your rate,
Oh, interesting.
and then they just, you know, and so I started doing some work for them, and it just kind of grew organically. And so I just started doing a lot of expert witness work, and it became so lucrative at that time. I had actually kind of really started ignoring my practice, to be honest with you, because it was so much easier to just.
This is the hard part with side gigs, like slippery slope.
And so, but the problem became as that business grew, and I also was approached by a friend that does Social Security disability, which is another kind of medical legal system. And he's like, well, it's a federal contracting job with the government, but they solicit for like new docs like every 5 years. And he's like, they're soliciting now. Like, it's a really good gig. You should apply. So I did, and then I got it. And then I eventually somehow, even though I'm an ophthalmologist and not like a general internist, became the regional medical advisor for them.
Oh, I love that.
And so,
It's like taking a life of its own.
I mean, it was not super intentional, but it just kind of happened. And so I kind of started doing this other work, and I'm like, wow, I can do this from home. I can do this in my pajamas. And
All for
I, you know,
that.
like I need to go pick my kid up at school. Like, I can go do that. I'm not tied to seeing patients in the office. I'm like, this is great. And so the problem became is that I was doing this on my nights and weekends. So I pretty much had no life. I pretty much got to a point where I had no free time and like no life.
This has the opposite effect of where I was going.
Right, exactly. And so I think things are just always changing and figuring out how to balance them out. So then my idea was that I wanted to cut back practicing. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of morphed into this whole dry eye thing. So I still have a comprehensive ophthalmology practice. I still do a lot of expert witness work. I still do my social security disability, but I'm working on morphing into really just niching down into this dry eye practice.
Yeah.
And so I have this kind of small niche practice, and then I can do my other stuff.
Yeah.
I can continue to do my other stuff on the side, but I can do that during Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 kind of hours, and not be working.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Not have to do that nights and weekends.
And I like the variety. I mean, I like you. I mean, doing legal work, like you use your brain in different ways. Every case is different, and you kind of have to think things through. And I mean, because sometimes I feel like practice can be mundane. You do the same things like day in and day out.
Especially when you niche service, you know, like you're like, I'm seeing the same thing all the time, which if you love it and it's something you like, great. But yeah, it can get monotonous.
And I love it. I mean, I do like it, but I like the variety. I mean, I like the variety. I don't want to do the same exact thing every day. So I think having that side, I didn't really want to give up my side gigs, but I didn't want to be working all the time. So, that's a work in progress.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this.
I still work too much, but I'm not as bothered by it because I know things are going in the right direction and I'm getting there.
Yeah. Do you, what do you feel like is next for you? Are you kind of just going to continue on this trajectory of developing, you know, these cash services and still doing the legal work? Do you have something else in mind?
I don't know. I feel like the one piece of it that I've struggled with a lot is the marketing.
Sure.
I feel like marketing healthcare stuff. So right now I'm kind of focused on learning that piece of it.
Yeah.
I feel like I've hired some people to help me. The company that built out my website, they wanted to do, once they were finished, you know, with my project, then they wanted to, we'll do SEO and we'll do social media. And it was a huge waste of money. It was completely ineffective. I'm like, they did a great job on my website. They make things look beautiful and this and that, but doing like SEO and social media is not their thing. And I should have just, you know, I trusted them because they did a good job on my website.
Right.
And so I wasted a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. Having the right marketers is so important.
I think it's easy to waste a lot of money. I mean, there's a lot of people out there. Marketing is like one of these things where a lot of people charge a lot of money. They promise you the world and they just don't deliver at all. Finding a good, that's another thing. Like, again, going back to like finding a good person, but like in the marketing world, that has been a challenge for me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So are you spending a little bit of time kind of teaching yourself SEO and, you know, doing ads and stuff like that?
I've read about it, but it's again, one of those things like I only have so many hours in a day.
I'm not
to add more.
Right. Like, should we be doing this?
So I actually just kind of hired a marketing coach. He's actually a physician.
Okay.
And he's got a direct pediatric care practice.
Okay.
And so he teaches like physicians how to market themselves.
Oh, good. Good.
And then I have somebody that I just hired who's reasonably priced that's helping with he's more like social media, like getting your, getting your message out there. And then based on another doc's recommendations, I hired somebody to do some SEO, like make some changes to my website, making, you know, book now buttons so you don't have to scroll down, just little changes like that. So I recently hired her. And so far she's been really, she seems on the ball. Like, she's texts me all the time and is very communicative.
Which
I feel like in my previous experience, experiences, it's just not been a relationship that has been positive.
Yeah. I mean, I went through like 3 different marketing companies initially. There was a period of time where I too kind of did some of it myself and, you know, kind of figured some of it out. But of course, this was also when I was less busy. So it was like, I had a little more time on my hands to be able to educate on that kind of thing. And then, I think I got kind of lucky with the group I'm with now. Like I've had them for about 7 years and it's just been, yeah, it's been really, really great. And they kind of handle everything for me, but I will agree with you. Like just cause you can build a website doesn't mean you can do social media and SEO. Like,
well, and I feel kind like of two different groups. Like there's the building the website, there's SEO, there's social media, and they're not, one person isn't necessarily good at all of that.
No.
So I do really feel like I need to learn more of the basics of like, you know, because I feel like if you don't know it, it's hard to hire somebody good.
I mean, yeah. There's a certain amount of, I think, training that we need to give ourselves, just like in everything, right? Like we need to know a little about billing to make sure that the billers are actually doing what they're supposed to do. We need to know a little about marketing so that we can make sure that, you know, the marketers are doing what they say they're doing, and that you're seeing a difference, you know? So, and it does take like 3 or 4 months to really find out if a, you know, a new marketing tactic's really working. And that's the other part that's really hard. It's like, you're sinking money into this for like 3 to 4 months before you even know if it's working.
It's kind of the tracking. It's like, okay, like I don't really care how many likes or followers I have on social media, to be honest with you. I care like how many, and I know it's all kind of tied together. Like I get that, but at the end of the day, I care like how, is this bringing patients into my office?
Is this converting into an appointment? If the answer's no, then why am I doing it? Yeah, no,
and
I agree.
Feel, and I'm still working on this, but I feel like that piece is kind of hard to figure out how
it is.
It is.
Well, okay. And
we'll get,
you know,
it makes me feel better.
Yeah, no, that's a really common problem because a lot of times you have these, you know, these like CRM programs, like your, you know, your reputation management and stuff, and that, and a lot of them now, you know, you can have the calls come in or the messages come in directly to that. And with those, yeah, you're able to kind of track, you know, how they go through, where they're coming from. And then it stops because these don't typically hook up to your EMR. So it's like, you know, your last step on the CRM is, yes, we made an appointment. Well, okay, but did they actually come in for the appointment? Like, did that actually convert into being an appointment, you know? And so there is kind of this weird gap in between those two where you can kind of lose people and it's really hard to track that and keep that going. So yeah, I agree. It's not the easiest puzzle. I think it's good if you have a good team.
So that has been a piece that's probably been the most challenging for me is like figuring. I feel like that's the last stone.
Yes. Yeah. It usually is, right? Especially for cash services. Cause like if you want to be advertising for those types of patients, those ideal clients that you're looking for to be able to come in and know about you, right? Like that problem of obscurity where you're just unknown for this particular service is your biggest hurdle when you're looking at marketing.
Well, and there's so many dry eye patients that are looking for docs, the ophthalmologists that offer these services. Like they are out there searching. So I do really feel like the online piece is really important for cash pay services.
Yep.
And when you're in a more traditional insurance-based model, you're more relying on your referrals from docs or this or, you know, patients. You know, for their friends. But I feel like in the cash pay world, if you're going to attract the clients that want these services, like you really have to get out there.
Absolutely. Online. Absolutely. Yeah. You have to put yourself in front of the right places for sure. Well, this
has
been
another
super
thing that I don't love.
I mean, none of us really do. We just are like, oh, we have to.
That's a hurdle I'm still working on.
Right. Oh, there's always going to be that challenge for sure. Well, this has been really, really great. I think people will really appreciate hearing kind of the transition that you made from like space sharing to like really developing these niche services. And even, you know, the medical legal work part of it. I think there's a lot of people that are looking
for
options. Yeah. Like you've gone all the way around. I love this. This has been fantastic.
I mean, that's a good thing about being old.
Yeah. You are not old. That is.
I turn 50 next year. So I feel like I'm not freaked out about it, but I feel like it's been really motivating to just kind of be like, okay, what do I really want now?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, we kind of start thinking about that for sure. So if you had a couple of like book recommendations that you feel like really, really were influential for you, either from a practice standpoint, personal growth, business. I always want to get a couple of recommendations for people, for listeners. So
one of my favorite books was called The Gap and the Gain by Dan Sullivan.
Sullivan.
Have you? I don't know. Yep. Have you?
Yep.
I think it's just, it just really hit home because I look at just the progress. I mean, when we sit here and talk and I look at the progress that I've made since, you know, I would say even like July of 23 when I was, you know, evicting my partner from our, or not partner, but my space sharing partner from my space and the fear that I had. And I really think back upon that now. It really wasn't that long ago.
No.
And I have made, and I've built this like pretty significant cash-based business in like, it's, you know, growing and successful and it's not quite where I want it to be, but it's like on its way.
Yep.
But I really, most days don't take time to really stop and think about that. So I almost feel like I need to like go back and reread because I know there's all these exercises.
Yep. Yep. I feel like I read that one at least once a year. Okay. I have not mastered
being
and in the
other,
game.
The other thing, Atomic Habits.
Oh yeah.
I mean, because I feel like, especially if you have a small practice and you're the one in charge of it, just having systems in place and habits, it's just, you have to use your time efficiently and you have to get rid of bad habits and you have to, sometimes I think it's just easy to be overwhelmed by all the different facets that you have to be on top of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I love the Atomic Habits book. Again, another one that I have to like regularly revisit because it's not in my repertoire to normally separate stuff out quite as well as they talk about in the book. So those are fabulous.
I think it's just, I mean, it's just a way I think to help you achieve better, not just to make your business more successful, but to achieve more work-life balance because it just makes you more efficient.
Yep.
You have to be efficient.
Yes.
There's too many things to do not to be efficient.
Too much to do.
If you're not efficient, it just erodes into your personal
life. Oh, completely. And so easily, like it's so easy for us to sacrifice our personal life for like, I'll just use up my evening for that. It'll be fine. And then
that's my MO. So I work really hard to
right time delineation. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Sarah. It's interesting that our paths have aligned. So
I know. Well. I know. I was thinking that as you were talking. I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds really familiar. So wonderful. All right. Well, we will hopefully keep in touch and talk soon. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Sarah. Have a good one.
You too.